Movies and Booze. I'm Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
We're coming to you today from the Triskell Arts Centre in Cork with thanks to Marks and Spencer's D. Reddy, Deirdre Malumby and Leslie Williams. Join us once again. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
So finally we're going to get to talk about Snow White,
yes.
Deirdre. And was it everything you didn't think it was going to be?
I actually have a sentimental connection to Snow White because this is the very first movie I saw on the big screen. It was one of those like reissues of the Disney movie. So yeah, I was a bit sentimental going into it, but I was disappointed, as we'll get into, and kind of annoyed, to be honest. But yes, we will talk about this.
And the other one, Y2K, is this kind of, you know, because people of a certain age, you'll remember the huge panic about Y2K and the world would come to an end. Is this kind of a film speculating that everything does come to an end?
Yes, and it's kind of an apocalyptic kind of horror comedy, I suppose you'd call it. Also starring Rachel Zegler, which is funny. But yeah, it's kind of, do you remember like years ago there was a Simpsons like Treehouse of Horror episode where everything started coming to life and like, you know, attacking all the characters? It's kind of that as a movie. So I'm kind of surprised we ended up getting it now in, you know, 2025. But yeah.
Yeah, but
kind
then again,
if
Y2K came true and destroyed everything, then 25 years later, you wouldn't be able to make a film about that.
That's
so it's kind
true.
Of undermining itself.
In a way, yes.
In a logical sense. And there are two reds and a rosé.
Okay. We have the one everyone is drinking now is a nice blush pink Pinot Grigio. As I think I may have had to say this exact before, Pinot Grigio is a pink grape. People think it's a white grape. It's not. That was just a style invented in the 1960s, picking the grapes young and crushing them off their skins. Pinot Grigio should, if you treated it like normally, you would get a pink grape like this. And this is from the Venezia, so between Venice and Verona. I like to think that...
It's very pink, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's nice. You know, but it's that classic pink that everyone likes, you know, that like lighter Provençal colour pink. But no, it's dry. It's got a bit of creaminess and completely different to Pinot Grigio. So if you were buying this looking for... honestly, watery Pinot Grigio.
Yeah,
you're going
yeah.
to be disappointed. It's. I think this is pretty good, and I always think that this is how Pinot Grigio would traditionally have been made. So, if Romeo and Juliet in Verona, which is just beside where this is made, they were drinking wine. They would have been drinking pink wine like this, you know.
Two-year-olds.
I was going to say, yeah, exactly.
Things are very lax in them days.
Yeah.
How come though some rosés look pinker than others?
It's skin contact. The more skin contact you give it, the more the pinker it will be. And this, I mean, people think that a dark...
That applies to humans as well.
Yeah. Point.
Yeah.
The Provence style is what's in fashion. And people think if they see a dark pink rosé, it's going to be sweet. Absolutely not the case. There's no reason for it to be sweet. The only reason it would be sweet is if you took it off the fermentation before it was finished. If you just leave it ferment with lots of skin contact, it will be dry like a red wine is. I mean, wine's natural place is dry. Wine is never meant to be sweet. You're supposed to just allow the fermentation to keep going until there's no sugar left. The yeast eats the sugar, which makes the alcohol, and it'll keep doing that till there's no sugar left, unless it's a very, very sweet grape, which might happen with a dried grape, in which case the alcohol gets so high that it kills the yeast and you're left then with residual sugar. And if you're ever curious about this, if you Google the name of a wine with RS or sugar and then G/L, grams per litre, somebody somewhere will have the text sheet online and you can find out how much sugar is in your wine. And you'd be amazed how much sugar is in Southern Italian reds, for example. It could be 10-11%. There's a certain American red wine that sounds like the Latin word for pharmacy. I won't mention it. That's about 17 grams of sugar. So,
yeah.
Now, and is it the tannin offsets it so you don't realise?
Yeah, and the acidity as well. So, in fact, I've been fooled. There was a Rueda that I was recommending, which is a dry white wine, I thought, and I was loving this. It was like, and I discovered there was 10 grams of sugar in it. No wonder, because we naturally like sweeter wines than we think. But again, it was balanced by acidity, so you don't necessarily notice. And that's okay, actually. I mean, as long as the wine is in balance, that's okay, you know? Rambling on there.
Yeah. So it was, but they will never put that on a bottle.
No,
much sugar.
They never will. But interestingly, some supermarkets, some people are quite open to it. Like some of the supermarkets, if you Google the wine, you'll find the tech sheet online, and it'll list the grams per sugar. So there's one supermarket which is rather foolishly putting all the ingredients, and for some of their very commercial wines, this would be kind of unusual yeast enhancers and things, but none of which are any harm. It's just they've got kind of long, complicated, sciencey sounding words. You're going to go, what the hell is that in my wine? I mean, mostly wine is, it's cheaper to just use loads of grapes rather than additives. But
so theoretically, should there be no sugar in a wine? It should be just,
well, it should be quite
alcohol.
Low, yeah. It should be low, yeah. Unless, as I say, I mean, so Amarone would be high in sugar because that's made with dried grapes. You pick the grapes in September and you don't usually ferment them until December or January, and they've dried the grapes slightly. So they're not quite raisins, but they've lost some of their moisture, and so the liquid is less there, so there's more concentrated sugar. So they can be 16, 17%. And then there is residual sugar left over because had they fermented to full dryness, they would be at 20, but the yeast can't live that long. So it's like Sauternes. So Sauternes is picked with dried grapes that have, you know, that are really naturally sweet, and that wouldn't be naturally 25%. But again, fermentation dies at about 13, 14, and then you're left with the residual sugar. But again, that's a balanced wine. People think sweet wines are, you know, it depends. There's actually quite a bit of acidity in some of those. So it's like German Riesling is really interesting. That it's never sweet. The really good Moselles are not sweet and they're not dry. They're a knife edge in the middle. They're both sweet and dry, and it's a fascinating style of wine. And I really like it. So nothing wrong with sugar. What I have a problem with sugar is when it puts the wine out of balance. You know?
Yeah. So this isn't not like...
No, this is probably three or four grams of sugar in this, I'd say.
Oh,
a little
grand.
More. Yeah. But I should say, by the way, sugar doesn't add that many calories. The alcohol is what's giving the calories. If you take the sugar grams per litre, because it'll be 3 grams of residual sugar per litre, you multiply that by 3, that's 9 extra calories. That's all there is in an extra. Now, if there's 100 grams of sugar like there would be in a port, then that's going to add on calories, but not that much. I mean, honestly, it's the alcohol that's the problem, you know?
Yeah. So ET is going to be sold for £700,000.
Yeah. So the original body model that was used in the making of ET, and which many people have such happy nostalgic memories of as a film, is the estate of a guy called Carlo Rambaldi has been included in a show in Sotheby's, which is called such things, 20th century horror, science fiction and fantasy on screen. So there's like a load of different film props that are being included in this, and they have the original E.T. that has been put forward by his daughter. He's a really interesting guy. Like, he had an incredible career. He worked in props, but also special effects makeup. And he was a real advocate for the kind of original art form of special effects and props and the kind of physical props that people use. He actually went on record to say that, and this was before he passed away, so it would have been in the kind of late tens, but he actually went on record to say that if E.T. was made then with the technology that was available at the time, he didn't think it would be a hit. Because if you took away the physical, it would probably be done with CGI, let's face it. And if you took away the physical puppet that the kids were able to interact with, it just wouldn't have been the same.
There was a guy inside that, though, wasn't there?
No, I think it was a puppet.
I'm not sure now. I think it was.
But I thought there was somebody inside as well.
Would imagine they had a number of them for different shots. Yeah.
But I just, you know, I'm just wondering, would it be stink? Because, like, guy sitting inside this rubber thing for hours.
I don't think that's actually a funny thing, because a lot of these film props from that era where they started using rubber and latex and stuff like that are actually degrading really, really badly. So there's a whole kind of argument going on between conservationists and restorers. It's kind of like, you know, if you pay $700,000 for the original ET, but someone's replaced all the latex on it, do you not, like, is it Theseus's E.T. rather than Spielberg's
one? We've gotten all philosophical now. Right, Strigger's broom. Right, you are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. We'll take a break, back in a minute. So, Millie Bobby Brown from Stranger Things doesn't pay her own Netflix account.
No, she doesn't.
Stingy wagon. Would you not get a free one, though?
Well, you would think that. And she was actually asked in an interview about another Netflix actor had said that he's on a family account or whatever, he doesn't have his own one. And so she was asked about this in an interview with her, and I suppose because it's Millie Bobby Brown and she is literally probably the most successful actor that Netflix have ever had. They've done a lot with her, and she's in that god-awful film, Electric State.
I couldn't finish it.
Yeah, I'm actually wondering if they understood the word state to be the way we understand it here in Ireland, like the state of that.
State.
Yeah. But, so you would think that she would be different, and obviously the person asking the question didn't. So to their great surprise, she was like, no, I'm still on my parents' account because I still consider myself to be a child, blah, 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 which is odd because she is already married. She's married to John Bon Jovi.
Wait, I thought you couldn't do that anymore. If you live in a different house to the account.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see if Netflix actually do ask her to roll back on that.
I'm pretty sure my son uses, he's in Italy at the minute, and he uses.
I think you can have a family account.
Yeah. Like as long as it's, but, yeah. But I stopped paying the full amount because we had like 3 or 4 logins, but it was costing me a fortune. So I halved it by making it just one. So he has to wait till I'm finished.
But you're not getting paid.
Oh, that's a good, I must do that. I get like multiple and they all deny it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And they're like, and they're in different continents. Yeah. They go, no, it wasn't me. I don't know why it's in Spanish now.
But you're not getting paid by them as well. That is, I suppose, the difference. People would expect that somebody who's one of their most successful stars would at least have the service. But I do suspect there's an element of this because she's been in the news an awful lot of late, talking about how young she was when she got married.
How old was she when she got
20.
But she's standing up to the trolls, isn't she? Like saying, don't be judging me for what... That was brilliant. That was really
good. Stood up to the trolls. So there was this picture of her that kind of went viral of her wearing sort of a pink tracksuit. And she's blonde now, so her hair's up on top of her head. And people were being really, really needlessly cruel about it and saying that she looked old, she doesn't. Saying that she looked haggard, she doesn't. And like just awful, awful commentary. So she actually posted a Daily Mail article that had gleefully pulled together all this kind of toxic commentary about her. And she made an amazing statement. She said, this isn't journalism, it's bullying. The fact that adult writers are spending time dissecting my face, my body, my choices is disturbing. And then she kind of went on to say that, you know, disillusioned people can't handle seeing a girl become a woman on her own terms, not theirs, and talked about the fact that, you know, people first knew her when she was a young girl. Mm. And so they're kind of affronted by the fact that she doesn't look the same as she did in Stranger Things when she played 11. And I think she really forcefully and very eloquently actually made that point. And so fair play to her. And then, like, actually, you know, on a kind of sweeter turn of it, Matt Lucas, who was quoted in that Daily Mail article, because he had posted something saying, Vicky Pollard character. Mm. But he actually came out himself and said that he was horrified that people thought, I think you look terrific, and I was mortified when they wrote that I slammed you because that's not my style and I think you're great. And then he explained to her who the Vicky Pollard character was, which is important context in that.
Yes, I would have thought so. Yeah, indeed. Right, let's move on to our second wine of the day. What are we
doing? So we have a wine called Gecko Rock. She's a lizard
Gecko
rock.
Gecko Rock.
Yeah. There's a white version as well in Shannon. So it's Malbec Shiraz blend, or sorry, Shiraz Malbec blend, and I don't know if
now, does that mean, is that important in that there's more Shiraz than Malbec?
They're not telling us, but I think there is more Shiraz. Usually the order is the higher they want, if it's a Shiraz Malbec, there's more Shiraz than there is Malbec. That would be the normal thing.
It's like if you get married and you have a double barrel name, the first name is the person with more money.
Yeah, that's the way it should be, yeah, exactly.
Or the better sounding name.
Yeah, exactly. We think of Shiraz as Australia, and it's Syrah, same grape from the Rhone. But South Africa, I would argue, is the second best place to get Shiraz from the New World after Australia. Australia does have the edge. But South African Shiraz is often excellent. And the Malbec is less common. By the way, this is fair trade, which was interesting. And it is true that there are a lot of small farmers out there, boer and black, growing grapes and so on. It's quite an unequal country in the whole wine thing still, but it's getting better and better. Because there was a time when, you know... South Africa is a really interesting country. It's got some of the coolest young people making wine because land is quite cheap around Swartland and places like this, and so there's all kinds of natural and funky stuff happening, and There's a guy making, you know, guys, maybe there's one particular guy, I won't mention his name, but like he'll be using maybe, he makes 80 wines or something, you know what I mean? Like based in Swartland, if you look up some of these guys, they're really interesting. And so it's a cool part of the world. But then some of the commercial stuff can be a little uninteresting. I think this is actually solidly made, though. Nice and juicy and fruit-focused, you know?
Okay.
You don't see much Malbec. Malbec is there to kind of add a bit of juiciness to the Syrah, which can be, the Shiraz, which can be quite kind of dark and brooding, you know? I won't make any comparisons.
Yeah. Like you did. Yeah, no, no, it was time. There's still no vineyards there that are kind of very old world, and that are owned,
yeah, there was a big Swedish expose.
And slaves and stuff.
Huge amounts of wine in bag and box stuff sells in Sweden, for so very inexpensive stuff. And that's just a thing that they have in Scandinavia. They love their bag and box. It's like half the market. And there was a big Swedish expose of some of the farms, and I mean, effectively almost indentured slavery, almost in terms of how the farmers were, you know, being paid almost nothing. But I mean. I mean, there are some black-owned vineyards now, and if you visit, they will bring out the black winemakers to meet you and so on, to say, look, we're trying, we're getting there. And, you know, I know there's a winery called Goats du Rhône, which is instead of Côte du Rhône. So that they've recently invested in Swartland and have a whole black team and so on. And actually, the owner got beaten up and robbed extremely badly with broken bones and stuff, and was in work the next day, and put pictures of himself up with his bones. Says, "You're not going to stop me, lads. I'm staying here, and we are supporting our community, and this community is going to rock on." So there's heroes like that, and he's a man in his 60s at this stage, and this was not an easy time for him. But there is determination from the liberal, and the wine media, the wine guys are quite liberal. If you want some historical context, I mean, back when Mandela was released, the winemakers were not interested in supporting a new black-owned government because they reckoned they were going to lose all their convict labour, and they used to pay them in the DOP. The DOP is sort of in spirit alcohol made from leftover grapes, and keep them drunk and keep them quiet. But that did change, and I always remember Nelson Mandela for the World Cup, which happened, I think, a year or two after he became president. He bet a case of wine versus a case of South African wine, and he made a huge effort to reach out to the winemakers, and that wine is part of our culture here. And so I think that they softened then after that, and now generally I'm very positive about South Africa, but I will admit that for a long time I didn't want to buy South African wine. Yes. But I do think that actually that they've really come on. And as I said, this is fair trade, which is important because there are some small farmers out there, poor whites and poor blacks, growing grapes and so on. But there is interesting things happening. There's all these old vines, like, because a lot of farms, the Boer farms, would have been mixed farms where they might literally had 2 hectares of vines and that were planted in 1910. And so there's now this website called iamold.co.za, run by this woman, which allows winemakers, especially the cool young ones who've met at, maybe they've, you know, South African guy comes to work in Languedoc and meets a cute Spanish girl, and then they end up marrying and moving back to, or the other way around, and move back to South Africa, and then because they can afford to set up a winery there, and then but they're then finding that there is an old patch of Palomino vines in this small Boer farm, and then the farmer then is getting 5 times what they would normally get from selling to the co-op, and that's, there's movements like this in South Africa, so it's quite a positive, interesting place for wine. And as I say, there's really cool stuff happening on the margins. The big guys are still, can be a little too commercial, but that's the same in any country. I mean, the big commercial Australian stuff is not interesting either, you know.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. Right, we do have to take a break. More movies and booze to talk about after this. We might as well move on to our first movie of the day. It is Snow White. Here's a clip.
Please. You were saying.
It's just, Your Majesty, people are struggling, and it may not be much, but when I was young, my parents and I we'd pick apples. We'd take them and make pies and then go out into the village.
Pies are luxuries. They don't need luxuries. It confuses them.
But sometimes something small, something sweet even, can make you believe that there's more to being alive than mere subsistence.
You know, I really don't remember you being this opinionated.
My apologies. It's just, I feel they need some kindness.
Fearless, fair, brave.
Right. That's Snow White now. It's been covered in it exhaustively of the controversy around it, who doesn't like who supports Israel, who supports the Gazans, all that stuff. When you take the actual film on its own terms, telling the story probably most people are familiar with already.
Yes. So we probably don't need a plot summary here.
Yes. So, and now the thing about the Seven Dwarves, they're not played by real actors. They're animated.
So they are real actors, but they've been like CGI remade over. And it's quite awful, to be honest. I don't know why they thought that this was a good idea. So basically, of the seven actors who are playing dwarves, only one of them is an actual dwarf. His name is, I'm trying to remember it now. It's Martin Gleba. People might recognize him from Pirates of the Caribbean. And actually, they do have another dwarf elsewhere in the cast. There's kind of this side plot going on with this like group of bandits who are kind of trying to rebel and rise up against the queen. And there's a dwarf there as well. But I mean, in terms of representation, I think the decision to make the seven dwarfs of the title CGI was an absolutely mad idea. I think it's really awful. I thought it was very dehumanizing. And not only that, but the actual characters themselves are portrayed as very kind of, like, they might as well be called like clumsy, dopey and inept and names like that, because they're just these like seven caricatures who are just like bumbling around and falling over each other and constantly like bickering with one another. And there are like kind of silly little lines where they're trying to give more depth. Like Grumpy talks about how he's not grumpy, he's misunderstood. And it's just like also forced and painful. And I just found it really, really quite infuriating, because on the one hand, and Peter Dinklage, who is the actor from Game of Thrones, when they kind of announced that they were making this movie and that Rachel Zegler was going to play Snow White, he actually was quite open about the fact that he was quite infuriated by the fact that they were remaking this movie. He said that it's backward, like, haven't I done enough in terms of, you know, representation of little people? And you watch a film like this and it just sets back that representation by like years and years, because you can just imagine like a bunch of like kids going to this movie and being like, haha, look at that, look at them. And I just it didn't sit right with me at all. I thought it was quite awful. And I mean, like, Disney, on the one hand, you know, they cast Rachel Zegler as Snow White, which was seen as like quite revolutionary. You know, you have like a Latina actress who is playing like Snow White, typically very like, you know, Caucasian character and everything. And then on the other hand, they do this in terms of like representation of like little people and dwarfism. So it was quite, it was quite upsetting to watch.
Like, maybe they didn't know what to do.
They didn't know what they were doing. No. Because then you did have dwarfs in the cast, but then they made these kind of crazy creative decisions. So that's just one of the elements of this movie that I was really put off by. Now, but there's more to come.
The evil queen and the kind of kingdom they live in, from what I've read, it's a democracy, but it's not really, or they keep changing their mind, and you're not too sure what's going on.
It's like America.
We're all clear what's going on there.
So I suppose in terms of like the representation of the kingdom itself, like when we first enter as Snow White, everyone is immediately like singing and dancing, you know. So if it's a musical you're looking for, you're definitely going to get plenty of songs in this, though not too many from the original movie, you'll be sad to hear. But basically the kingdom is all like singing and dancing. They're wearing a lot of the colours that you'd recognise kind of from the palette of the original movie, which I could appreciate that, you know, at least they're nodding back to that. But then basically the queen dies and the king goes away, and, you know, like we know the traditional story, Snow White is then raised by her stepmother, who is played in this by Gal Gadot, who is like the evil queen, and she's kind of become this dictator. And then, you know, under her rule now, all of the people who are living in the kingdom are wearing these like grey drab like sad clothes. And I was thinking like a bit of like Frozen or something like that, you know, like once the king and queen go away, then everyone in the kingdom is like very sad and stuff. And I suppose like what my interpretation of this anyway was, they're kind of almost taking a bit of inspiration from, you know, that Kristen Stewart movie Snow White and the Huntsman from years ago, and how she's kind of trying to like lead almost like a rebellion against the queen and get them all to like stand up to her. So I suppose that's a way in which they like modernize this story. And also there's no prince anymore. He is now the love interest in this is kind of like the leader of the bandits, and he gets his own musical number called Princess Problems, which was enjoyable enough. A bit kind of, you know, musically Broadway, that kind of thing. But then when Gal Gadot started singing, Oh my God, it was...
She's really bad.
Awful. Like, so embarrassing. And actually, in fairness, like, when I was watching her, you know, in scenes like that and other, you know, scenes in which she's kind of meant to be, like, evil and menacing and sinister, like, you know, she chews the scene up. I thought that she was quite good. And then when she tries to start singing and dancing, I was, like, actually watching it, like, through, like I could now, barely
do you,
watch.
Do you remember
so
during the pandemic when she did the Imagine video how cringy that was?
Yeah.
Was it on the, if that's your 11 on cringiness, was this even worse than that?
I would put it at a 12.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow. Do you reckon someone on the production really doesn't like her because they've kind of been letting her hang herself?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, I get what they're doing here. They're trying to, like, stretch the movie out. I think it ends up being, like, an hour 45 minutes or something, and the original was something like only 70 minutes long from what I remember or something. So obviously they're going to have to put in more musical numbers. As we've seen with all these live-action remakes so far, usually they bulk up the running time by adding in all these musical numbers, and obviously you've got to get a bad guy musical number in there. But as we know, usually with the Disney movies, they're like the weakest numbers of them all. There are some fabulous ones like Ursula
from...
I know.
Yeah, she wants to have
I love
a word
that. I love that. other fans of Little Mermaid here now. It's just really, really cringeworthy. I mean, there's so much auto-tune. It's unbelievable. Like, clearly she can't actually sing. But even like watching her performing, like trying to like, you know, do a kind of like Broadway thing. It just didn't work at all. God love the poor woman.
So the film in general, are we going to, it didn't not work at all?
There were moments of it that I quite liked. Like, for example, the whistle while you work number, I thought was actually quite magical. And they have Snow White kind of dancing around with like the dwarfs in that scene. And I actually did find it quite charming. So it had its little moments. I liked, like I said, the Princess Problems number as well. So it did have like kind of little moments almost that it could have been a good movie, but generally speaking, no, it's not a good movie.
Do you think it's a problem with the live action ones? Because I've never really liked any of them that much, but the original fairy tale ones, so they're all based on fairly problematic material from the Grimm's Brothers fairy tales. And then you add in the problems of whatever era they were made in. So you're kind of trying to shoehorn something modern into two pretty problematic texts.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one. I just don't think that any of these live-action remakes have been necessary. Like, the only one that kind of stands out to me as I thought was actually better than the original was Pete's Dragon, and that's because they took, I suppose, a more, like, obscure Disney movie and then did and kind of expanded what was quite a, like, simple story and made it quite sweet and charming. But all the other ones, like, none of them are any good. I think that if this one... you know, tanks at the box office, which a lot of people are saying it's going to do, I don't think that they're going to stop making them. I think they're just going to put a bunch more like direct to streaming, which they've done so far with the likes of the Pinocchio remake, the Lady and the Tramp remake. See, people don't even remember it. They've already done live action versions of
Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah. And it's with like Tessa Thompson and Justin Theroux. Like there's very little left for them to do.
It just takes away the magic of the animations.
Yeah.
They'll start doing the Toy
Story
ones next.
Yeah. God, stop. Speaking of evil queens, the big interview with Gwyneth Paltrow in Vanity Fair. Now, the thing about making out with Timothée Chalamet, that's been kind of reported. What other nonsense did you
listen, do you know what? I would actually, if you have an hour and 45 minutes to spare, instead of going to see the Snow White film, read this, because it's one of these old school long form celebrity interviews in Vanity Fair. I mean, it even opens with the line, "I'm Gwyneth," she says by way of introduction, and of course she is.
Yeah.
And then it goes from there into some of the most hot nonsense you're going to hear in a long time. And there's actually something enjoyable about it, because in the news cycle that we're living in today, this is just a glimpse into someone who lives literally on another planet. Like, she has her staff talking about what a good mum she is. They call her a super mum. And then the journalist does point out that they do work for her. She's asked about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and she's really cagey about those kind of questions and the pseudoscience, because, of course, she has goop as well. So she doesn't actually directly answer the question about RFK, but she does actually repeat some of the same sort of pseudo-babble. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think people should just start calling him Rob or Bert by now, because like he's ruining that name for everyone. Yeah. She's asked, this one's interesting to me, she was asked about Meghan and Harry because they live down the road in Montecito, and also because Meghan has now launched this new lifestyle TV show and stuff. And you can see that they were so angling for her to be mean about them. And in fact, the kind of the way it's been reported, especially in the Murdoch-owned media, was like, Gwyneth said, I don't know her. Which is true. She said, I don't know Meghan and Harry, which I'm surprised by given how close they live. But I'd like to meet her. Maybe I'll try to get through security with an apple pie. So, like, hardly slamming them. She actually goes on to say that she'd welcome any woman wanting to go into that space. She talks a bit as well about the Marvel movies. I thought this was gas because it's just such a Gwyneth thing. She had no idea she was in 7 movies for Marvel and had to be reminded of, I'd say, the latter half of those. She talks about Goop a good bit, obviously. And a direct quote, Sean,
this is my favorite.
I knew it would be.
Yeah.
A direct quote from the article. So I'm not sure if everyone's aware, but just to recap, she, for a while on this website, Goop, was selling vaginal scented candles. So her direct quote is that vaginal scented candles aren't scalable. So that's something to take home with you.
It's difficult to generate a huge amount of vaginal scent.
Well, there's that. And then, I mean, I suppose there is going to be a finite kind of market for it, I would imagine. That was a bit of a problem as well.
I put an image in my head of how they actually make these.
Yeah, listen, thankfully it didn't go into that. She's asked about her ski trial as well, which was hilarious when she was sued by that guy for bumping into or knocking him over.
She came quite well out of that one, though, actually.
She did, yeah. And, I mean, it's arguably the most waspish form of litigation that you could get is to be accused of a ski injury.
Why is she making a movie now anyway, seeing she hasn't done so for a long time?
Yeah, I mean, look, she kind of stepped back from Hollywood, I think, more so to focus on raising her kids. The kids have now moved out. They've gone to college. And now she's...
And they're never coming back.
she seems... She seems like a kind of well-meaning person, but she is one of these people who has been so famous for so much of her life. I think it's almost hard for her to conceive of what, you know, just a normo's life might be.
Yeah.
You know?
Leslie. Yeah. let's tell us about the third wine.
So third wine today. Now, this is a bit more, it's Rioja. We have a classic Rioja. I shall read out the name of it, which is Paco Real Rioja in a nice orange label. Grape is Tempranillo, which is the classic Tempranillo, is the classic Rioja grape. Rioja is really near, by the way. I mean, you know that you can get a boat, Brittany Ferries do a boat from Cork to, or no, it's Rosslare to Bilbao. And then like 45 minutes drive to Harrow, which is the original classic Rioja town. And then there's a walking tour you can do of 10 of the most famous wineries. And then Logroño, then there's just another 40 minutes south, and that's really famous for its tapas. It's a really, really cool part of Spain, and it's really near. And like we drove there 2 years ago, and it was lovely, you know. And Spain's great, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. It is. Sorry, I mean, every country is great. I mean,
yeah. No, they're all equally great.
Yes, exactly. But who doesn't want to go to Spain to go to Rioja? So Rioja from the north of Rioja Oriental is the southern one around Logroño, around the River Ebro, and that's Grenache based. So if you find the sort of oaky style of Rioja too strong, that southern style, which is more juicy and fruit, and that's a bit more what this is going for, that soft, juicy. I'm not getting a huge amount, any oak off this particular. I suspect it's unoaked, or I suspect it's a Joven, a young Rioja. I'm not getting any oak anyway. We tend to think of Rioja as that sort of American oak, vanilla, coconut smells and tastes, and it's a process almost. It's very much, you know, that there's also inexpensive, especially organic ones and stuff, that is juicy, bright, fruited style, which is more what this is, you know.
Is there a difference between an Italian Rioja and a Spanish one then?
Sorry, I said Rioja Oriental. It's just that the southern... There's Rioja Alavesa, there's just different regions of Rijeka. So no, there's no. I mean, so Rijeka just is the village, is the region. So,
right. Okay.
Yeah. So no. No Rijeka in Italy.
Yeah. So they're pretty much all the same. Right. Let's move on to our second movie of the day. It is Y2K. Here's a clip.
Stuck in a copy of The Giver at the library.
Just watch. One of these days, maybe even tonight, one of us is going to use it.
There you go. That's Y2K. Even by looking at it, it's they seem to have got a pretty, you know what period of time it is just by looking at them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it hasn't happened yet, I assume, or is this a post Y2K world?
No. So basically, the setting is New Year's Eve, 1999. Who you would have seen on the screen there are two best friends and high school nobodies named Eli and Danny. They are played by Jaden Martell. You might have recognized him from, he was the main kid in It a few years ago. And then Julian Dennison, he would be known for Hunt for the Wilder People and Deadpool 2. He's kind of this like crass, like naughty little boy, and now he's like grown up a bit and he's playing these kind of more mature roles. But yeah, they're two kind of, I suppose, high school dorks who decide to crash a party that one of their schoolmates is hosting, which is kind of hailing in the new millennium. Another person who's attending this party is Laura, played by Rachel Ziegler, who Eli has a major crush on, and Danny is telling him to, you know, shoot his shot with her because they get along quite well. They both kind of, he helps her out in Spanish class and everything. And yeah, they've just heard that she and her boyfriend broke up. So, you know, this could be
this
Eli's
could be
chance.
It. Yeah. It could be. Now, is this in movies or in cinemas, I should say?
Okay. This is in cinemas.
On a comparison between this and Snow White, where Snow White is a total disaster, where are we with this?
I found it a bit of like fun myself. I mean, I loved all the like late 90s nostalgia in it. Like you have dial-up internet and old computer graphics, references to, you know, like Limp Bizkit and Slim Shady and MTV, songs like Tub Thumping and the Thong Song song feature. So I found it a bit of crack. There's some laugh out lines in it. As with any comedies, it is better to like see it with an audience rather than kind of on your own. But I think it will prove a bit of a difficult sell because its characters and its immature sense of humor kind of suggest it's aimed at a younger audience, and yet like younger people probably wouldn't get the references in it. So yeah, it might prove that it kind of like almost falls between these two kind of awkward categories. But for my money, you know, I won't say how old I am, but I found it fun.
Okay. Yes. 25-year-old Deirdre Malumbi really enjoyed that. Dee, Deirdre and Leslie, thank you all very much. That's our lot from the show today here in the Triskel. Thanks as ever to everybody in the Triskel and Marks and Spencer.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.